Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure this evening for me to welcome Mr. N. Ram as the guest of the Asia Research Centre and of the LSE. We're very grateful to you, Ram, for agreeing to give this talk this evening, and as I say, it is a pleasure and a privilege to have you here. N. Ram is a fighting investigative journalist. He is the founding editor of a remarkable news magazine called Frontline, and he's now the editor-in-chief of The Hindu, the great English-language daily newspaper of Chennai, used to be known as Madras, a newspaper that has been described by the Columbia School of Journalism as being amongst the 10 best newspapers in the world. The Hindu was started in 1878 as a weekly at that time by six young Indian nationalists, and as a newspaper in the later colonial period, it was emphatically identified with the nationalist cause. The Hindu quickly established really the standard, I think, for serious and responsible journalism in India. And Ram, if I may venture a criticism of what I commonly say is my favorite newspaper, it is that The Hindu is the most unremittingly serious newspaper in the world. It makes the Financial Times sometimes look slightly flippant. But I'm sure you have an answer to that one. I mentioned sort of responsible and serious journalism, and this is a cause actually for which Ram has devoted a good deal of energy in recent years. And amongst the other things that he has done latterly, he's been to be very much involved in setting up, establishing the Asian School of Journalism in Chennai, which has taken on the task of providing a training for young journalists in the different media from across Asia. Ram might have become an academic historian. I think he could have made an academic career as a historian, but he found his vocation, found his métier in journalism. At an early stage in his career, he was the Hindu's correspondent in Washington, and I recall at that time that he did a very interesting piece of investigative journalism, which was basically finding out about some rather secret deals that the then government of India was doing with the International Monetary Fund. Later, he was really in the forefront of exposing, following up scams surrounding some of India's defense procurements. And in 1995, he won an award, the National Citizens Award, I need my glasses at this point, for his brave and fearless writings in the interest of the nation. And the importance of his work as a journalist has been recognized both in India and internationally. He holds a number of prestigious awards, perhaps the most significant of them being that he is a holder of the Padma Bhushan, which is one of the most important awards made by the Indian government. And I don't know exactly how it compares with awards in this part of the world, but I guess it's something, you know, in the order of being a knighthood, something of that kind. But Ram is a multifaceted person, and one of the facets which I am particularly fond is that he was in his youth actually a first-class cricketer, played for his state as I think a wicketkeeper batsman or batsman wicketkeeper, and his passionate follower of cricket. He's also the biographer of the great Indian novelist in English R.K. Narayan, a passionate follower of Carnatic music. There are many facets to his interests and to his personality. N. Ram has been very close to the heart of India's public affairs for 30 years or so, and I think there are few people who could possibly be more qualified than him to speak to us this evening on the topic of India's place in the world. Ram, it's a great pleasure to have you here. The floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our answer to that problem is Mario Garcia, the designer, the Hindu, has been through a comprehensive redesign, and our content is struggling to keep up with the new design. But there we are, and we are trying to keep up. India's position in the world. Let me begin on a rather obvious note, namely that the theme of India's place in the sun is much discussed among Indians these days in various places, and there are unsurprisingly divergent and conflicting visions of where the country is and where it seems to be headed. Equally obviously, the vision is determined by where you are located in the political and ideological spectrum, by your socioeconomic background, to an extent by your geographical location in the subcontinent, and of course by your worldview. Within India, the visions of the country's future in relation to the world range from the extremely bullish to the positively downbeat. The supporting analysis and arguments are rooted at one end in extremely optimistic projections of India's economic performance and development, and usually it goes hand in hand with uninhibited realpolitik. At the other end, they are rooted in preoccupations with basic livelihood and human development issues, and with moral concerns over recent and current foreign policy directions. To his credit, our president, APJ Abdul Kalam, in his inspirational speeches and writings, has picked up issues from both ends. His grand vision, what he thinks must be the singular goal of students and youth in particular, is the transformation of India into a developed country by 2020. This status will be complete with what our head of state terms PURA, or the provision of urban amenities in rural areas, but also with an armory of nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and other means of mass destruction. I'm afraid this kind of vision meets with a large measure of skepticism in India, even among those who think India is on a good sporting wicket but with uneven bounds, as we sometimes say contradictingly and confusingly in cricket. To be a true believer in 2020, you need in fact to be a transcendentalist. You need to persuade yourself that the world's largest mass of endemic deprivations and other features of a less developed society can somehow be overcome in a matter of 15 years. Of these features, please consult the tables and also pages 30 to 31 of the UNDP's latest Human Development Report, HDR 2005. The hard foundational work of social development that needs to be done is discussed by Amartya Sen and Jean Dres in their book, India, Economic Development and Social Opportunity, an analysis of endemic deprivation that is still terribly relevant. It also analyzes the role of public action in meeting the challenge. As recently as May 2004, a ruling party's election slogan of India Shining bombed in the 14th general election. The newspaper commented editorially that, and I quote, "India Shining must be given an award for the worst advertising campaign of the last 5 years, because by seeming to mock the deprivations of the mass of voters in rural as well as urban areas, it opened up a huge credibility gap for the ruling party. The contest lost by the BJP and its allies, and also by the Congress in certain places, on mass livelihood issues offered salutary political lessons. In my assessment, the Manmohan Singh government does not appear to have taken these lessons seriously enough. More on that a little later. Let us say there are deep anxieties as well as robust hopes over the socio-political health of the country and the performance of the democratic institutions that are sometimes the pride and sometimes the despair of millions of Indians. Most informed Indians are proud of their democratic elections, of the way the Election Commission and the rest of the election machinery work, and the healthy electoral turnout. In the last general election, close to 300 million people, that is 58% of the country's 670 million voters, turned out to make their choice on numerous electronic voting machines. Most informed Indians value their constitutionally guaranteed freedoms and mostly in consequence seem to hold the independent higher judiciary and the relatively independent news media in reasonable esteem. The emergence of an active public opinion and citizen sector associations in the recent period has been heartening. The widespread corruption and abuse of power, what is known as the criminalization of politics, the acts of authoritarianism, major and minor, the institutional accountability deficits, and the high dramas and soap operas of, say, Bihar and Uttar Pradesh remind us of another side of democracy. At another level, India-China comparisons figure frequently in media, business, and public discourse. I believe this is a very relevant and worthwhile exercise. It's a return in some ways to the debates of the 1950s, when comparisons between Red China in revolutionary transformation and democratic India, following a somewhat different path, were inescapable. The present comparisons are fueled by plausible notions like Thomas Friedman's theory of flatism or leveling. As those who have read The World is Flat know, enlightenment dawned on the New York Times pundit during a 2000 conversation with Nandan Nilekani in Bangalore. The Infosys CEO was describing how information technology was leveling the international playing field for corporations and countries, and suddenly Friedman got it. My God, he's telling me the world is flat. As a review of the book in The Hindu by one of our best analytical journalists, Siddharth Varadarajan, points out, the Friedman argument, constructed on 10 flatteners, I won't go into them, you can read about them, is extremely superficial. It is ahistorical, unable to distinguish qualitative from quantitative changes, tendentious perhaps, and at the end of the day, some of it is quite silly. I'm sorry, but the world is still round and also dangerously prone to conflict, especially on account of Bush-led flatteners, asserts the reviewer. There is yet another kind of vision, a sort of civilizational divining on offer from no less than V.S. Naipaul. His essay I read recently published in the October 2005 issue of Tatler is titled, To Thine Own India Be True. The great man has been quite attracted to recent socio-political and cultural happenings in India. These attractions include Indian cinema, which fortunately, to quote Naipaul, cannot apply for a green card and leave the country, and what the Sangh Parivar has been up to under the signboard of cultural nationalism. Sarvedya is clear that this is a potentially dangerous time, that India's future cannot lie in high economic growth alone, and that now more than ever, India needs a sound intellectual life. With some caveats, he is an almost romantic admirer of what he calls India's own unrecognized cultural revolution. In his far from apolitical novelist's imagination, it is being waged on new and deep-going questions of history and nationalism, a development of the nationalist argument from the independence movement, as he puts it. How this kind of eagle-eye vision translates into empowering India, I leave it to this resourceful audience to figure out. By the way, Empowering India is the evocative title of a recent series of articles in our Indian Express. to which I contributed recently an essay on the Indian news media. This gives you an idea of the discourse, the issues that figure in the discourse in India. The need, it is clear, is reality testing in the various domains on the key issues. As you know, in psychology, reality testing is the technique of objective evaluation of an emotion or thought against real life as a faculty present in normal individuals but defective in some psychotics. The reality check in our case must be against the defining themes in the debate on India's fast materializing positions in the world. These themes have acquired cult status in India and abroad. They have acquired such influence that the anchor of a BBC Asian Network radio show I was interviewed on this morning proceeded to anticipate what I was going to say today at the LSE about India's emerging superposition in the world, given its burgeoning economy, its increasing global integration, and its nuclear weapons. I had to correct her, saying, no, my assessment was going to be critical, realistic, and I hoped nuanced. Whoever is bold enough and brash enough to attempt the grand exercise of predicting India's position in the world by, say, 2020, is likely to come up with answers that are complex, mixed, contradictory, hopelessly inadequate. Such is the nature and intractability of the challenge. There are also great expectations and opportunities involved. It's clear that as one of the world's fastest growing economies today, India is making waves internationally. Recent pronouncements by President George Bush, Prime Minister Tony Blair, and other Western and also Japanese, Chinese, and ASEAN leaders, not to mention the mostly gushing global media coverage, have come as music to middle-class and elite Indian ears. Of course, there are critical voices within the Indian press and academia. They have pointed out, for instance, to quote from an article we recently published in The Hindu, that Mr. Blair, when he peers into the intermediate future and marvels over the global implications of China and India becoming the world's largest economies, each of them with populations three times that of the whole of the EU, he's pursuing his own political and ideological agenda. He's essentially using China-India as the bogeyman, as this article put it, to persuade EU countries to reform their economies. He's trying to sell the Anglo-American model of lower taxes, rolling back of government, and flexible labor laws, enabling easier hiring and firing of workers as an alternative to the social model of France and Germany. Incidentally, Making Sense of Chindia, Chindia, is the title of a little book published this year by Congress Party ideologue and MP Jairam Ramesh. A key principle of government outlined in the National Common Minimum Program of our coalition government, the United Progressive Alliance government headed by Manmohan Singh, is to ensure an economic growth rate of at least 7 to 8% a year in a sustained manner over a decade and more. The economy, which registered a GDP growth of 8.1% during the first quarter of this financial year, seems very much on course. The satisfactory monsoon has helped substantially and raised spirits all around. The industrial and service sectors have registered impressive growth, with manufacturing doing quite brilliantly in the first quarter. Inflation running under 4% annually seems under control. The stock market boom is above expectations, even if the markets are characterized by some volatility. Media markets, I'm delighted to say, are booming in both the news and entertainment sector. A JP Morgan appraisal of the Indian media industry released in May of this year projects a 14 to 15% annual growth rate for the entertainment sector over the next 3 years. It foresees overseas market opportunities on a new scale, with the possibility of 30 to 40% of revenues coming from overseas markets in 2 to 3 years for the entertainment sector. High technology exports are doing exceptionally well. India is clearly a favored FDI destination, although not yet anywhere approaching the Chinese level of $50 billion plus in terms of annual FDI inflow. Foreign exchange reserves, if not in the China-Japan League, are at a healthy $143 billion, according to the most recent data released by our Reserve Bank. But as some of India's finest economists and certain management specialists have been cautioning for a while, there is another deeply worrying reality. It is obscured by official assertions, particularly by our finance minister and also the prime minister, and by propagandistic coverage in the Indian media of the Indian economic boom and the reform process, opening up a huge credibility gap again. That there is a crisis of agriculture and the rural economy is not just the assertion of left-wing economists and investigative journalists like P. Sainath. For some years now, it has been a constant theme in the writings, speeches, and policy efforts of India's most distinguished, most eminent agricultural scientist and food policy expert, Professor M.S. Swaminathan. The Prime Minister and also Congress President Sonia Gandhi have publicly recognized the existence of the crisis of the rural economy. In a recent newspaper article, the economist Utsa Patnaik highlighted the fact that India's annual per head absorption of food grains is at 154 kilograms, one of the lowest in the world, actually 20 kg lower than what it was 6 years ago. A chilling conclusion is that, and I quote, there is already a sub-Saharan, this was an article again published in the Hindu, something interesting there. There is already a sub-Saharan Africa within India. Half of our rural population of over 350 million people are below the average food energy intake of sub-Saharan African countries. The reality is captured by India's latest HDI ranking of 127 out of 177, actually 34 places below Sri Lanka and 42 places below China. The really bad news seems to be that the higher trajectory of Indian economic growth has not meant any kind of concerted attack on mass deprivation, above all in the countryside. This, in fact, is in striking contrast to what China has done over the past two decades, notwithstanding certain significant deficits. HDR 2005 characterizes India, somewhat diplomatically, as a globalization success story with a mixed record in human development. Quoting our Prime Minister as saying, as candidly acknowledging, that the record on human development, to put it mildly, has been less impressive than the record on global integration. What is clear from the various data, interpretations of which will continue to be disputed, is this. India, despite having certain developed country characteristics, has the greatest mass of endemic deprivations among all countries in the world. This is the huge challenge. HDR 2005 reckons the incidence of income poverty in the national population of over a billion to be somewhere between 25% and 30% today. It estimates that malnutrition affects half the country's children and that one in three children is underweight at birth, reflecting poor maternal health. HDR 2005 finds that at a national level, rural unemployment is rising, agricultural output is rising at less than 2% a year, agricultural wages are stagnating, and growth is virtually jobless. It warns that pervasive gender inequality, interacting with rural poverty and inequalities between states, particularly between the poverty belt, northern states, and states like, believe it or not, Gujarat and Tamil Nadu, they're doing pretty well in these respects, is undermining the potential for converting growth into human development. Making a determined dent on this situation is the major political challenge any regime faces in India, in my understanding. And I say it as much in a political sense as in a socio-economic sense. I don't propose to go into any detail on India's complex and evolving political situation, but I must emphasize one aspect that is hotly discussed today in the media and in public fora. What I'll attempt here is to spotlight the nature of the challenge and the opportunity before the UPA government, the United Progressive Alliance government, headed by Manmohan Singh. Let me remind you that this is a minority government of 15 political parties headed by the Congress. It exists because it is supported from the outside by the left, which has an unprecedented strength of 64 members, predominantly of the Communist Party of India Marxist, in our Lok Sabha. The UPA regime is supposed to function on the basis of a 24-page covenant called the National Common Minimum Program, NCMP, hereon. Conventional wisdom in the Indian news media, in business and management circles, and among influential sections of the middle classes, views the NCMP as something of a diversion imposed by the painful exigencies of dependence of this coalition government on the left. It's a diversion from the great task of forging ahead with the economic reform project initiated by Manmohan Singh himself in 1991 and of empowering India to take its destined position in the world. From time to time, the government is advised by media pundits, although by nobody in serious politics, as though to behave as though the NCMP does not exist. Make the NCMP history could be the rallying cry for Indian neoliberals. I have no doubt it is a recipe for political disaster for any regime that is interested in a renewal of an electoral mandate. And contrary to conventional wisdom, I am clear the government's real challenge and opportunity is implementing the key promises made in this NCMP. The key promises include restoring and strengthening secular governance after 6 years of rule by a majority coalition spearheaded by a communal party, the Party of the Hindu Right. They mean promoting high and sustained economic growth as well as welfare, wooing FDI in a big way in infrastructure, high technology and export sectors, but also enacting such measures, and that's where it could be different if they really implement it, the National Employment Guarantee Act, guaranteeing 100 days of assured employment at minimum wages, which are not yet fixed but could be in the region of 100 rupees a day, for 100 days in the year to every able-bodied member of a rural family that asks for it. This is the promise made. It's a gigantic promise. Attempts have been made to dilute this in its implementation, but thanks to the pressure of various of the left and various other players, including intellectuals in India, and also I think thanks to the support extended to it by Sonia Gandhi at a critical stage, this has actually been enacted, and we await details of its implementation. It also promises the NCMP a national midday meal scheme, a free lunch for school children, and it also rejects any idea of changing labor laws to mean hire and fire. The key promises include the doubling of rural credit within 3 years, introducing a cess on all central taxes to finance universal access to basic education, enacting a new type of Right to Information Act, and retaining existing Navaratna companies. These are 9-star profitable public sector companies that we won't privatize them or get involved in any disinvestment. That's been the promise made in the NCMP. The overarching socio-economic commitment of the program is captured by the slogan, economic reforms with a human face that stimulates growth, investment and employment. Is it possible? I'm not an economist, but it's an interesting challenge and question before India. The overreaching foreign policy commitment of the UPA government in its NCMP is to pursue an independent foreign policy, keeping in mind India's past traditions. This policy will seek to promote multipolarity in world relations and oppose all attempts at unilateralism. Going into some specifics, the Common Minimum Program promises the highest priority to a good neighborhood policy for promoting close political, economic and other ties with all of India's neighbors. There will be systematic and sustained dialogue with Pakistan, support for the peace process in Sri Lanka within the framework of the island's territorial integrity and sovereignty, an attempt to resolve outstanding issues with Bangladesh, and an intensive dialogue with Nepal. This agenda has been overtaken by what's happened in Nepal since, for developing water resources to mutual advantage. That's no longer the central concern, as you know. And with reference to China, trade and investment will be expanded further, and talks on the border issue pursued seriously. As for the United States, there's a cryptic reference in the Common Minimum Program, which promises to pursue closer engagement and relations, but the UPA government will maintain, this is said in proximity with closer relations, will maintain the independence of India's foreign policy on all regional and global issues, as though that came automatically into question. When you talked about the United States, you had to affirm your commitment to independence on all regional and global issues. The covenant also commits the government to deepening ties with Russia and Europe. India's most sensitive, big-ticket, if you like, foreign policy relationships can be said to be with Pakistan, China, and the United States. And following instructions from the chair earlier, friendly instructions, I will deal with each of these relationships in the time available for the rest of this presentation. But this will be from the perspective of promoting India's position in the world. It's obvious that in the wake of the terrible calamity, the natural calamity that has hit that part of Kashmir, which is in Pakistan possession, and also the Northwest Frontier Province, and that India cautiously offered assistance. The Prime Minister offered assistance, and it has been cordially received, although President Musharraf has been candid enough to say in an interview that sensitivities are involved, so we'll see where we can take them. But I think this symbolizes the good feelings that we have witnessed over the last 2 or 3 years as a result of a systematic policy of detente pursued from both sides despite obstructions and despite vacillations at some critical junctures. I won't go into the details, but detente, if it is not quite irreversible between India and Pakistan, it still holds traps. There are risks involved. But by and large, it is our feeling, it is our perception that detente is a serious process. It is in place and it is backed by much popular support, especially, I can assure you, in India. And much credit for this should go, if you are to be fair, to the government of Prime Minister Vajpayee, the NDA government, who, against all predictions, had a breakthrough in this respect. There were ups and downs in this process, but basically, as I understand it, what has happened is what happened in India-China relations earlier on. If not quite in that way, if not quite with those guarantees, something along those lines. It is clear that the Kashmir problem is intractable. It is clear to me that an Indian, that barring a solution through war, which we can rule out, fortunately, or most more or less rule out, there is no chance of any solution other than a formalization, if and when it comes, of the actual line of control, of the status quo on the ground, with some minor adjustments that may be mutually acceptable. This is not a position acceptable to the government and people of Pakistan. It's very clear. But that's why the huge gap remains, and it is an intractable problem. India has also, in the view of many of us, failed to deliver on the promise of autonomy to the people of Kashmir. These promises have been made repeatedly over the last decade or so, or a little more than a decade, but the governments have not been able to deliver on this promise because there's no clarity or no focus on what is acceptable. But another kind of a semi-breakthrough came more recently with the idea of soft borders, which I think holds great promise. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and General Musharraf have both more or less accepted this concept of soft borders, that cautiously you can try to soften the border. And that's the way to go. And we hope that the response to the present calamity will also demonstrate the virtues of this approach to living with the problem of Kashmir and trying to improve the situation on the ground, But basically, you must go for improving relations all round. What is known in our part of the world as normalization. Normalization must take place in various other spheres. And this was an idea that I first heard in February 1979 from the Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping, when then Foreign Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee visited Beijing. It was an early bird attempt to normalize relations. It was not possible for a complexity of reasons at that time. But later on, in December of 1988, when Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, besieged at home by the kind of troubles that John has referred to, went to China, an actual breakthrough took place along the same lines. And again, Deng Xiaoping was there to preside over the process from the Chinese side. And the basic idea was what the Chinese have been advocated reasonably over a long period, and many people in India have been supporting for a long time, that unilateral claims on boundaries that have not been settled, not even demarcated, are unacceptable, are foolish strategies for great states to pursue. Unilateralism doesn't pay, at least in our kind of context. It has to be on the basis of give and take, which is a very hard outcome to achieve. Meanwhile, and that's a very long period covered by the meanwhile, you have to behave normally. You cannot let the problem dominate you, is the lesson that India learnt successfully from the late 1970s. There was a breakthrough in 1988, and everything good in Sino-Indian relations that has occurred has taken place on the basis of a mutual realization. And this realization, I think, has spread to the people of India and probably in China too, so that it is an enduring relationship, notwithstanding tensions that arise from time to time, minor tensions or at least discordance. In the case of Pakistan, it's a much more serious problem, because the Indian complaint is cross-border terrorism, its rise, its ebb and flow. It's usually blamed on Pakistan in a direct or indirect way, and demands are made that General Musharraf and the Pakistan government do something to stop this, or at least minimize this, and they of course deny it. So there are serious problems in the way, but normalization of the kind that has taken place partially in the last 2 years has to go forward. In other words, people must be allowed to travel. Visas must be given liberally. People must be allowed to go to each other countries for various reasons, to study, for example. And this is the way to go in India-Pakistan relations. We have no doubt about it. Anyone who resists this today has to take the high chauvinistic ground in India. Otherwise, it is not accepted by at least informed public opinion, is my observation as an editor. Letters to various newspapers reflect this. They indicate the public mood to a certain extent. And on the whole, we are positive about the prospects, the outlook for India-Pakistan relations in the period ahead. And Prime Minister Vajpayee, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who's continued it, General Musharraf, and all other players in Pakistan who supported it, must get full credit for reversing what is a very dangerous trend, particularly in the wake of the nuclear weaponization that after the Pokhran nuclear explosions that took place in both countries in May of 1998. It's a considerable achievement, I think, that this happened against the odds. This, I think, helps India in a very sensitive area of international relations, regional relations, but international relations, to assert, to go forward in the world. The second major challenge, and I think that's very important, is relations with China. I've already given a basic assessment of how it has gone. A breakthrough has occurred, and most recently, during the Chinese Premier's visit to India, that is Premier Wen Jiabao's visit to India, an important agreement was concluded on the political parameters and guiding principles for the settlement of the India-China boundary question. And it has various principles are sketched, there's a long way to go before you can actually move towards a settlement. But the process, the serious practical process, has started, or at least is on the point of starting, when you are talking about the huge challenge of resolving this boundary dispute between India and China. But everything else about it, I think, is very, very positive. The trade level this year is very promising. It in the first 8 months of 2005, bilateral trade between India and China was $12.2 billion, and it promises to overtake the record level of last year. This is a considerable leap. Earlier we were talking about $1 billion between the, in terms of two-way trade, but this kind of economic interaction, quite intensive at this point, rivaling India's trade level with the whole ASEAN bloc, I think is extremely promising. So I think India will do very well to keep on course with China, interact with China on a number of regional and global issues, not just bilateral problems. They are fairly modest today in comparison with what needs to be faced. And it is clear that the only mistake, the one misstep that the government of India took during this period following 1988 was in the wake of the Pokhran nuclear explosions, when Prime Minister Vajpayee, perhaps thinking the letter would remain confidential, wrote to the US President blaming China for its nuclear explosions. And thanks to investigative journalism, the US didn't take even 12 hours for the letter to become public in the New York Times. It became a serious problem, but fortunately a short-term problem in bilateral relations. Relations were frozen. I visited China during that period and learned quite a lot about what was expected. They didn't quite object to India's nuclear ambitions, because they claimed that we can't practice double standards. But what they objected to was scapegoating China in an unfriendly way for what occurred, for totally different reasons as they saw it. And once amends were made by the Indian government, basically through an unpublished apology, I think things were back on course again. And this, I think, is an extremely positive story of political challenges well met on both sides, and particularly, I think, on the Indian side, because the Indian side was much more vulnerable, having lost in the in the earlier conflict of the early 60s, as was widely perceived. The world has changed since then, and both countries have changed phenomenally. And I think this is an aspect of India's positioning in the world that is worth celebrating. Finally, on this most tricky issue of all, the problems of dealing with the United States. I refer to the earlier cryptic statement in the National Common Minimum Program about keeping close relations, intense relations with the United States, and juxtaposing it with a promise to maintain an independent foreign policy course. This is the area, I believe, where the Manmohan Singh government has been least successful in this. It follows up. In fact, people, commentators in India, critical commentators, don't see much of a difference between the Vajpayee government's foreign policy towards the United States and the Manmohan Singh government's approach. Both supported, it appears, the National Missile Defense Project. The Vajpayee government came close to accepting the Bush administration's demand or request to send Indian troops to serve in Iraq. Prime Minister Vajpayee intervened himself to stop it after promises seemed to have been made by his deputy prime minister visiting the United States. And the framework agreement on U.S.-India defense relationship recently concluded by the Manmohan Singh government was prepared for by the Vajpayee government's policy with respect to defense cooperation and co-production of defense equipment and support for the missile defense, National Missile Defense Project, which intriguingly at that stage was supported publicly by the Indian government. Manmohan Singh's recent interactions with President Bush in Gleneagles, in Washington, again in New York, and most recently India's extraordinary performance vote at the Border Governors meeting of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, speak to what is seen as a dangerous turn by those who are opposed to it, as a dangerous turn in Indian foreign policy, with specific reference to the United States. I think this comes from the ambitions that we are talking about. There has been a preoccupation, an obsession with securing B-League membership, permanent membership of the UN Security Council, notwithstanding a lack of agreement all around. China is very sympathetic to the Indian demand, but China says we can't support the package deal, the all or nothing deal that the group G4 are supposed to be demanding or standing for. The United States, because China is opposed to Japan's becoming a permanent member with or without a veto. The US has publicly stated that it is opposed to Germany becoming a permanent member, but India, for some reason, the government of India seems to be obsessed with the ambition of gaining what is clearly B-League membership in the UN Security Council. This is not likely to materialize. When anyone comes, whether it's the UN Secretary General or any leader of any major country comes, sometimes even small countries, the success of the visit is judged by, the success of Indian diplomacy is judged by, whether there's a formal support for India's membership, permanent membership of the UNSC, which I think is, to put it mildly, a misguided project. Maybe it can be part of your ambition, but his obsession is not only unseemly, it seems to be unrealistic and not very wise. But these are the kind of ambitions that lead India into a very soft position on critical issues. And the most recent case, which is, I think, telling, is the decision to vote adversarially against Iran in the IAEA Board of Governors meeting. Everything that was said on behalf of the Indian government, including by the foreign minister, indicated otherwise. They said that Iran had the right to develop its nuclear energy. It had the right to enrich uranium. But when it came to the crunch, we wrote an editorial on it titled India's Shameful Vote Against Iran. And the decision showed a willingness to abandon the independence of Indian foreign policy for the sake of strengthening what in strategic circles is regarded as a strategic partnership with the United States. This decision was made in stealth, without any kind of discussion within the government or with allies and national political parties. It was made at the level of the Prime Minister, and it clearly contradicts proclaimed Indian policy. It bears emphasis that the resolution adopted by the board, 22-1 with 12 abstentions, has grave international implications. Specifically, it recalls Iran's alleged failures in a number of instances as a party to the NPT to meet its obligations under its NPT safeguards agreement and its alleged policy of concealment. Adopting a menacing tone, the resolution finds Iran in non-compliance in the context of a particular article of the agency's statute, and among other things, the article allows the board to report the non-compliance to the Security Council and the General Assembly of the UN. The resolution also finds that Iran's nuclear activities and the resulting absence of confidence is exclusively, that its nuclear program is exclusively for peaceful purposes, has given rise to questions that are within the competence of the Security Council, and as many of you know, November could be an important month of decision in this regard. And the Bush-led resolution, as we see it, is unjust as well as provocative. If the idea is to find a solution through intelligent negotiation, Iran and the IAEA have resolved most of the issues in dispute. In fact, the IAEA Director General was recently given the Nobel Prize. reports that good progress has been made in Iran's correction of the breaches and so forth. But to cut the story short, why did India support going against all its proclaimed statements, all its statements before that, vote in favor of this resolution, breaking ranks not only with the entire non-aligned movement, not only with China, Russia, and so on, but also with Pakistan. Pakistan abstained. India voted for. In the run-up, we believe that much of this is related to India's ambitions, nuclear ambitions, and ambitions in the energy security field, which has been a major preoccupation of this government. Because India's nuclear power program is in a bit of a crisis. It does not, we do not have the natural uranium required to power a nuclear power program that they hope will yield 20,000 megawatts to 30,000 megawatts in the intermediate future of nuclear power. And in July, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh concluded a deal on civilian nuclear energy cooperation with the Bush administration. It's full of conditionalities, ifs and buts. There are many things uncertain about it. But basically, we supported it. People like me, our newspaper also supported it with some caveats because it was a constructive deal. Because it reined in India's nuclear weaponization ambitions. And it did promise as a quid pro quo, as a reasonable quid pro quo, some supplies of nuclear fuel and other sensitive nuclear material in return for India's segregation of military and civilian nuclear facilities and also accepting IAEA safeguards on what was designated civilian. This work is yet to take place, but basically I think it's a creative idea because the only people who opposed it are those who want to make dual use of our unsafeguarded nuclear power plants like Kalpakkam, so that most of the time you produce nuclear power for economic reasons, but when you need it, you turn it towards military use, a truly Strangelovian prospect, because it's totally unfeasible, technically not smart at all, economically not feasible at all. But the hawks in India advocate that kind of dual use of nuclear power plants. So the cap put on this, the cap apparent seemingly put on this by the deal, the Indo-US deal signed in July, was welcomed as constructive. But it had its repercussions. And that, I think, part of that was the United States is now able to dictate, because it was discussed in the U.S. Congress very candidly, that unless you vote with us on Iran, unless you call off the gas pipeline, the whole project, whether it will come off or not, who knows. But the U.S. is clearly saying, don't go for it. Go for other sources. Go for nuclear power, and we'll turn on the tap. We'll convince our Congress and the nuclear suppliers group to relax the well-known regime, this is a test case in international nuclear relations, but we believe that this has put cruel pressure on the independence of India's foreign policy, its policy to the United States in particular, this has been severely criticized across the political spectrum in India, by the left, of course, but also to some extent by the BJP, and various others within the Congress party also. There is tremendous confusion on this issue. And I think if in November India votes the same way and the situation explodes or escalates and then explodes, there could be a major crisis, political crisis in India. That would have been one of the biggest blunders committed by the Manmohan Singh government in pursuit of their present policy. I want to conclude on the note on which I started. It's a very complex issue. It depends on your vantage point, how you are affected. It depends on what you are discussing. But basically, India has done reasonably well, but it has in some areas. It has done quite well in most areas of foreign policy, in neighborhood relations. It's done exceptionally well in handling relations with China. It's done reasonably well in handling relations with Pakistan. Its economic growth rate has been good. It's performed well in several sectors, but the huge deficits and challenges remain. And any reality testing, any reality check would lead you to those areas. The Common Minimum Program, the National Common Minimum Program, which is very unfashionable among those who advocate neoliberal policies and our present economic reform, unpopular in the finance ministry in our government, in the Prime Minister's office. They are stuck with it, it appears sometimes. But that provides the basis on which this government could intelligently differentiate its policies from what went on before. If the government does well, it can consolidate these advantages. The opposition is in crisis at the leadership level, but it must not be underestimated. So political stability and the health of the present government, the secular government, which many Indians support, depends to a large extent on your grounding yourself in this covenant and seeking to implement it in as earnest a manner as possible. The other way to go would be to totally sideline this in domestic policy as well as foreign policy. So India is at a crossroads in that respect, and when it pursues the project of becoming a global power, asserting its position in the world, it cannot escape from these basic realities. Thank you, John.
We have some time for questions, and I know the Tram will be very happy to answer questions. I have several myself, but I see several hands up, so let me not abuse my position. One, two, three, four, five. Please remember your
Thank you, Professor John Eilis, and I thank LSE for bringing the editor of our national, if not our national, South Indian newspaper to give us a current insight about the India's position. I think that it also includes Indians' position, because we, the ordinary Indians, think that India equals to Indian population minus our corrupted and greedy corrupted politician and greedy bureaucrats. The issue, I got two issues, because my newspaper always comes out with a supplement. So I got one major question and another supplement one. The major issue is that the British politicians, whether we go to Labour Party meetings or their governmental meetings, they are much concerned about the India universities churning out with a lot of graduates. So I don't know whether you as an intellectual or as a media observer, are you concerned about this? The reason being, the young Indians, we dream bigger and we rather achieve a lot of higher success. But the problem is, we have to choose either the caste-based corrupted system or the color-based arrogant system. So what do you think that this India's position in the United, if we achieve a seat in the United Nations Security Council, whether that is the powerhouse of the Indian politician can do what them, so many dealing or will dealing, so that the Indians, whether they are in the rural India, they can go to university and come out with a big, good degree and come to LSE like this and have better recognition. Thank you. Mount Road Mahavishnu Junior, thank you.
Should we take three or four to begin with? Athar?
Yeah, just to pursue the question about India's foreign policy. I think India used to have a unique position in the Middle East. And with India's vote against Iran and slightly sort of closer relations between Israel and India, especially on military front, seemed to have changed India's unique position, which occupied in the Middle East. The second, I'd like to come back to question other part of Asia, that is in India's position vis-a-vis ASEAN countries.
Vis-a-vis ASEAN countries. Third, Thank you.
I would like to know, if Manmohan Singh government fails to deliver to the poor, so what political options do these people have? Because we know what BJP is.
And then over here, please.
You said just at the end that there didn't seem to be much enthusiasm amongst even the government, this government, for fulfilling those minimum goals stated in the, was it NCMP? Seeing as a lot of the Western world, certainly in Europe, seems to be talking a lot, including the politicians, about trying to achieve the millennium goals for sub-Saharan Africa, what's your answer to, well, why isn't there some kind of groundswell in India itself along similar lines to achieve that kind of thing in India, by India? Don't they feel, or some of them, that they might be pretty ashamed should sub-Saharan Africa totally overtake them, even if they do, as you said, in some spheres have economic improvement?
And last one of this round.
Thanks for coming, Mr. Ram. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Arvani said that he would resign from the BJP leadership in December after saying that Qaid-e-Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah was a secular leader. I'd like to ask, how much do you think his decision to resign was motivated by his comments? What future do you see for Indian nationalism and Pakistan's engagement with Israel? What do you think India's position on Middle Eastern affairs would be in the future?
An extremely mixed bag of questions. So I think, Ram, you should have a chance to reply.
I think on India's policy towards West Asia, yes, there is that criticism has been made. It's been in the making for some time that a special, not only normalization of relations with Israel, which I think would be perfectly acceptable, but some kind of special relationship has emerged, particularly with the BJP government, and Mr. Advani particularly pushing that, and Israel has become a supplier of military equipment. And this has created problems, which, as you say, have been made much worse by the vote against Iran and the IAEA. But they have made that choice. And again, this only brings me back to the point that the Manmohan Singh government's foreign policy is virtually indistinguishable from the foreign policy of the previous government. There may be some areas we're waiting to see whether it's different. But that criticism is well taken. The other point about, the Millennium Development Goals, I think these have been, of course, written about in the press, seen in largely formal terms as a target to achieve. But in India, the problem is pretty clear that you have, because we have a whole literature on deprivation and poverty, and there have been several activists seeking to build an agenda, a public agenda, to force governments to respond to this issue in states as well as at the national level. It is the estimate of many economists that we have about 300 to 350 million Indians living in appalling conditions, extreme poverty. They have chained the lines so that the figure has actually come down in the official estimates, but the UNDP estimate I mentioned, it is a major problem. Why are there? I think there's a lot of concern. And in fact, as I mentioned, the 14th general election, the election of the parliamentary election of May of 2004, largely revolved around basic livelihood issues. There was severe drought. Some of the states which were acclaimed internationally for being reform-minded, the Andhra Pradesh, for example, they fared the worst. The ruling parties did very, very badly in the elections because everywhere they were rejected. Largely because they were seen as insensitive to mass deprivation and mass poverty, and particularly, I think there have been a very large number of
starvation deaths and farmer suicides in India. I think the figure is now reckoned to be something like 7,000 over the last year, and it was on a huge scale before that. And government shut their eye or gave various excuses to what was happening, which was being reported in the press, actively in the press, in the Indian language press, as well as by those like Sainath, who have specialized in this area. They've turned up case after case of what looked brilliant early on now is a disaster. And I think the left has picked it up, various academics have picked it up, the press has picked it up to a certain extent, but that's there's only so much you can do when major political players are involved on the other side. But the Millennium Development Goals themselves figure only marginally in the Indian debate because the problem was already internally defined. But we have a huge problem on our hands about there's still no law, no national law requiring that all children, even of primary school going age, should be in school and shall not be part of the labor force. We don't have any system of truancy officers to ensure that we're talking about the primary level. I'm not talking about 10 years, which is the demand made by most sensible people. So there are huge problems, institutional problems in India. And the Supreme Court, which has intervened very well on certain issues, has not been sensitive to issues of this kind. Any number of judgments on how high professional colleges, engineering colleges should be run, very few judgments on basic rights, although there were judgments early on which declared that primary education is a fundamental right. And the law, there's been an act, an enabling law, but no enforcement. There was one other question relating to ASEAN, yes. It was the Narasimha Rao government which started a fairly successful policy of what was called Look East. And at the last ASEAN summit in Vientiane, Laos, India had a very fruitful interaction with ASEAN leaders and also with the Chinese Prime Minister. The trade, the two-way trade level between India and ASEAN is about, when I last heard, is about $12 billion. A new agreement has been signed with Singapore. So I think this is a new facet of India's foreign policy, an area, a region largely forgotten earlier on till this was one of the initiatives taken by the Narasimha Rao government in which Dr. Manmohan Singh had an important role. Economic diplomacy became important. The ASEAN conflicts had largely died down. And this was a time when India could, in a very congenial way, engage with ASEAN and take it forward. So I think it's a success story. Political options for the poor in the short term do not exist because this government has to deliver. I recently, a senior minister in the government told me that everyone seems to be underestimating the BJP just because there's a crisis. The high drama, the burlesque of the BJP's leadership crisis, but that has misled many of us to underestimate the capability of the BJP. It's still the government in waiting. If it gets anything like 140 or 150 seats when elections come next, who knows? So BJP is very much a force, cannot be written off, and own goals can yet be scored by the present government. Mm. One fatal mistake, one serious mistake as on Iran, who knows how it would go? Because very hard to predict what will escalate. So far, the government has been fairly stable. It has met its crisis in a reasonable way, internal crisis, that is. The left has boycotted the coordination committee with the United Progressive Alliance because, why? That is, I come back to the CMP. A specific promise made on the Navaratnas, which I mentioned, in this case, BHEL, the government was about to violate in the reading of the left, They made a big point of it, and because the government is dependent on the left, and also because some smaller parties have supported the left on this issue, the government has retreated on this question. And there are other areas, landmines like the pension bill. If you go back on what the entitlements of senior citizens, that could be a very sensitive issue, not just in the United States or Europe, but in India also, and this government is coming close to moving in that direction. Again, the only restraining factor is what you're dependent on for political survival. But for the poor, for the working people, it's a hard choice, because the policies of the present government, the economic policies, are also not that much different, except where through public action and political pressure, they are made to accept certain decisions. Sonia Gandhi, I must add, in all fairness, we don't want to overstate the role of any individual because we don't know enough about it, but all reports suggest that she has been more sensitive to, as Congress Party President, to these demands and to the promises made in the NCMP than the Prime Minister, the Finance Minister, and most of the government. And she is an important player on the Indian political scene today, who is playing, in my view, a rather positive role as leader of the Congress Party. Also on the question of this vote on Iran, there are indications that Sonia Gandhi has a somewhat different pitch or tone. They don't break ranks publicly and say this government is wrong. They can't afford to do it, but there are enough indications. So there is that promise and prospect within the government. Its potentialities have not yet been exhausted. And you wouldn't expect them to be so soon.
I'm aware there's a host of people who want to ask questions.
I'll be brief.
To give them a chance. I'm sorry, Arthur. You've been trying to come in for a long time.
Hello, sir.
Someone's over here.
The nuclear blasts of 1998 were mainly conducted to leverage India's position in the world. On hindsight now, do you think it was a success or a failure? And if it has been a success, why shouldn't all countries do it as a quickest passport to get noticed?
I can only somewhat immodestly recommend my own little book called Riding the Nuclear Tiger, which is it's part of a campaign, and many of us, including the novelist Arundhati Roy, a former Navy chief, Admiral Ramdas, and many others, and also their counterparts in Pakistan, have spoken out against nuclear weaponization. You can't put it back into the bottle, but clearly it has introduced new pressures, not just in terms of neighborhood security and the security of our peoples, but pressures on India's foreign policy, India's nuclear energy policy. And the best story was told by Arun Shauri in December 1998 in Parliament, when he quoted then External Affairs Minister Jaswant Singh as saying, "It's like being in a crowded railway compartment." And I'm more or less quoting. "When you are inside, when you are outside, you complain about those who got in. When you're inside, you try to keep the others out." And this crude imagery encapsulates the formal pursuit of India's post-98 nuclear policy. And we have seen those double standards at work in the vote against Iran in the IAEA most recently. So, I mean, I'm pre-committed on this issue, and it's not really fair to take on your question, but I clearly, like many others, believe it has been a very counterproductive step taken by the Vajpayee government, certified by the present government, which wants to maintain it. We have our suggestions on how to de-escalate, but unless there's interest, I won't mention them here.
I'm going to try to move around because there are so many hands all over the place. Now I'm going to move from the left as I look at you to the gods. Please, shout out your question.
Thank you very much for your
And can I just take one more from the, all right, as I'm passing the gods. Narayan, please. Make it brief if you, please. And one last one for this round, right at the back there, please.
Good evening, sir. I just had two questions to ask. First, what do you see the role of the left in the future in the Indian government policy in the run-up to the next election? And do you think there's any difference in the views of the national and regional forms of the left?
The what?
The
national and regional forms of the left.
Huh. Any difference, did you say? Yes.
Yes, the first question relates to the RSS. The RSS remains alive and active. Its leader has been talking out of turn, it appears, and that is resented within the BJP. And the recent resignation statement of Mr. Advani in Chennai, in their executive meeting in Chennai, said it all, saying that while we owe our inspiration to the RSS, that's the cradle, and that's they should have a mentor's role and so on. But if they start micromanaging party affairs and intervening in decisions, then this is not going to be good for our movement. And that was a rebuke that was, I think, very well received outside the BJP and outside the Sangh Pariwar fold. The RSS remains fiercely committed to its communal agenda, to its anti-Muslim program, to its hawkish ambitions for India. It was the first to welcome nuclear weaponization in a very hawkish way, and is seen primarily as a weapon against Pakistan and China, which I think is, so far as China is concerned, that's completely off. The RSS remains a significant political force in India and will remain that for the conceivable future. The question is what the mass political party, the successful mass political party, the BJP, is going to be vis-a-vis the RSS. Will it take the Advani path? There is, I think, a differentiation. People tend to underestimate it. It's not just Jinnah. It's by the way, he didn't say Jinnah was a secular leader. He said Jinnah's August 1947 vision was a splendidly secular vision, and he has repeatedly made that clear. So Jinnah was a symbolic issue, and it opened up a set of differences between an experienced BJP leadership and the somewhat aloof, rarefied RSS level of leadership, because they are isolated from the people. They are in those khaki shorts, getting up early in the morning, doing Hitler-like things. That's the image that comes to mind whenever you see their pictures. They talk like that. They write like that. They also take the high ground on culture and character building and building moral values. That's the RSS. It continues to be a university for communal ideologues and politicians. It continues to attract some young people. The future of the RSS will be basically decided by whether it can maintain the kind of manageable relationship it has maintained with the mass political party it has given birth to. If it can't do it, if this part, if there is dissonance and contradictions of the kind we have witnessed recently, then they are in trouble. On the question of the press, yes, the National Readership Survey of 2005 brought out some revealing figures. The Indian mass media, news media, have become truly mass. Television reaches something like 450 million viewers, 108 million TV homes. The press is estimated to, the daily press reaches something like 170 million readers. Radio has considerable reach, although sadly it has been in decline over the last decade. But you are talking about very big actors on the Indian socio-political scene. And the Indian language press, as the research of my friend Robin Jeffrey demonstrates and continues to demonstrate, is buoyant. He calls it India's newspaper revolution, and from a low base it's been growing in an extraordinary way right across India. There is plenty of diversity and pluralism there, but there are in some media markets monopoly tendencies emerging. But what Narayan refers to is also the pressure that the market puts on journalism and the core values of journalism. This is a serious concern in India as it is elsewhere. We do not have the problem of declining circulations that you have in the UK or in the US and so on, in a quite a different context. They are called mature markets, and India is only not yet a mature media market, or most of the markets are not. But the pressures are there. Less from international sources, I believe, than from domestically engineered sources. The pressures started first in India, the market pressures. And people like me in journalism have come to the view that you cannot raise walls between the editorial functions of a newspaper and marketing, but you can draw lines. But what are the rules determining those lines is not yet worked out. Great newspapers claim that they know how to draw that line. It's internal or esoteric knowledge, it appears. But you do have to discuss benchmarking and issues relating to how to handle marketing pressures, because at the end of the day, the big Indian newspapers depend on 80% of their advertising, for us certainly, comes from 80% of our revenues comes from advertising revenues. So advertising subsidizes to a huge extent the cover price and therefore the circulation of newspapers. As for the television scene, terrestrial television is a monopoly. Doordarshan, it's a state monopoly. Nobody else is allowed to do a terrestrial television operation. But satellite television, some of you who are not familiar with the Indian media scene would be surprised to know, is completely unregulated. There's no broadcast law. It was as though the invasion came from the skies and nobody was prepared for it. It was accepted. It became hugely popular. But today, even today, there is no broadcast law, no sensible regulatory framework in India regulating anything. That they're trying to do it, but no compliance. For those who do not want to comply, it is a major problem, but it does provide choice, it does provide variety, there's some excellent programming, but usually, as television is adept as doing, and this is maybe partly a bias from a press insider, it is adept at dumbing down. Tabloidization is taking place in a big way in both the press and particularly in news television and entertainment television, the satellite channels in particular. So you have this, and then you have the whole entertainment sector, which I referred to in that JP, when I referred to that JP Morgan study. It's booming, and it is now becoming part of global operations. Lots of animal spirits out there for the media.
Yeah. Question on the left.
There's one other question I forgot.
Yeah. About the left, from the back there it was. No. There was the last question that I think that you at the back there asked about the left.
Yes.
The future of the left.
Yes, I think the future of the left will be restricted by the fact that its current strongholds are in West Bengal, in Kerala, and Tripura, and a few other pockets. How to break out of those strongholds, that's relatively small part of India, is the big challenge before the left. I don't think any positive answers will come in the short term. A new General Secretary, my friend Prakash Karat, has taken over for the CPIM, and they have put on the agenda the business of transcending this historical limitation. The left has historically been confined to these strongholds in India. You can say that big success story is West Bengal, because no other government in India has continued for so long, getting elected quite convincingly. And in Kerala, they've done pretty well. But at the end of the day, the left is not a minor force, it's a significant force. But the numbers are pretty small. And as you regionally, yes, there are regional compulsions, practical considerations. Sometimes what Chief Minister Buddhadev Bhattacharya says in West Bengal sounds different. The tone sounds different from what is heard from Delhi, from the Central Committee of that party. But that is entirely understandable. But the differences are not such as to cause any kind of conflict or crisis within, in most cases. So the bases are regional, but the outlook, as in some other cases, is national. But I don't see the left breaking out, transcending this limitation, and breaking out anytime soon to become a player on par with the BJP or the Congress.
One more round. I think it just has to be one last round. So could you please make your questions sharp and pointed? First of all, gentleman in the blue shirt who's been trying for a long time.
My question relates to India's diaspora. They've been economically very successful, UK and US as examples. With their interest now in participating in the economic boom at home, perhaps you give a comment on perhaps the positive and negative economic, social, political consequences in the coming years of that trend.
What was that?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the sort of punchline, as it were, of the question.
My question relates to India's diaspora, who have been very successful overseas. Given their interest in the homeland now, what might be the positive and negative consequences economically, politically, and socially of that interest in their homeland?
Thank you. Over here, and then,
thanks, I didn't think we'd have time. Well, there was certainly a tour de force, and I'm very glad that the question which I was going to ask you answered about Iran. That was a blot on the long history of India against apartheid, the hatred, Darcy, and so on. So I'm just going to India's position in the world. I wonder if you'd like to re-examine your position about India and the United Nations Security Council, bearing in mind that when the Security Council was set up, there was Great Britain, because it just won the war. The United States, because they won against Germany and Japan. There was the Soviet Union, which tore the guts out of the Panzer Division. China was in bits and pieces. France had been an occupied country. And India had 2.2 million men and women in armed, well-trained, and just given Japan the biggest defeat on land at Rohima. They have every right to be in whatever form or shape the new Security Council is going to be. I wonder if you'd like to re-examine your views on that.
All right, thank you. And the lady over there, please.
I'd like to hear your comment about India's aspiration within the United Nations system in the context of UN reforms, and also these new realignments, the alliance with Brazil and South Africa and the G20 and this new South-South cooperation discourse thing.
Mm-hmm. Those new alignments, right? Since we're over here, just back there. All right, that's fine. Then I'm going to move over to the right, because you two have been trying for ages and ages and ages, and this falling chairman hasn't given you a chance.
The environment has been quite an important scene domestically. Manmohan Singh has taken it upon himself to talk about the tiger issue, which has been quite sort of well reported in the media over the past couple of months. Do you think it's possible that the environment may play a role in the international scene for India in possibly positioning itself as a player on the global stage in political circles? You've talked about politics, you've talked about international relations, economics, but do you think the environment may be able to play a role at any level?
It is said that there is one person among five people in the world is Chinese, but this time it does work. My question is, I often have some talks with my India colleagues and friends. I think China, regarding corruption, China is more serious than India's, but they said India's corruption is more serious than China's. So for me, I think most of Chinese people, especially intellectuals, they think if China has opposition party or free media, maybe can supervise the government and we got less corruption. But it's puzzle for me that it seems that India got opposition party, free media. Why India's corruption is so serious? I think you as a veteran experienced journalist must have do many investigation reports about corruption in India. Could you tell me something about corruptions in India, or how serious, or what's the problem or resolvement for that? Thank you.
The last one, I'm afraid, I think, because it's after 8 o'clock. I'm so sorry to those who wanted to ask questions. I tried to spread them around.
Sorry, thank
Please
you.
Please go ahead.
My question is actually on civil liberties and India's position in the world regarding civil liberties. Just earlier this year, Narendra Modi, the Chief Minister of Gujarat, who allegedly engineered the Gujarat riots, was denied a visa by the United States government. How do you feel, or what suggestions would you recommend that India should take in order to rectify or perhaps tell the world of, to be a global leader in human rights as well? What suggestions would you recommend?
Thank you. Ram,
yes, India has unfortunately not been a global leader in human rights, civil rights. I think there are, we start with the problem of untouchability, where the record has been appalling in practice. And when these issues come up in international meetings, the approach is to be very apologetic, if not to cover up. But there are areas where I think India has contributed, but it's not a shining role in my view. On the question of the Security Council permanent membership, I'm sorry if I gave the impression I'm opposed to it, because certainly not. The point, I refer to this obsession when everything is judged by, especially when it's clear they're not going to do it, when the US is blocking it, saying do UN reform first, that's the priority before you talk about it, and don't go with Germany and Japan and so on. China says Japan, US says Germany. It's a non-starter, it appears, or it's very, very difficult. So a lot of time and energy is spent, and also there is unseemly public discussion of this, and there seems to be a lot of breathlessness about it. It is that I was criticizing, and certainly not, in fact, I haven't thought about at all who should be and who should not be permanent members of the Security Council. We can discuss that separately, but I'm sorry if I gave that impression. But thank you for the other comment on Iran. On corruption, yes, I think it's been a major issue. I don't know who is ahead in this respect, but certainly we have had controversies where top people in our government have been involved, and that has not really happened in China. The press says Rajiv Gandhi came under fire on the Bofors deal and various others. So there is that difference. But your question is why, with an independent or relatively independent media and so forth, opposition parties, why is there this kind of immunity from prosecution for corruption? And that's an interesting question, because for long, the legal system in India seemed to provide this immunity. Criminal investigation in India is not really independent. That's one of the big problems. People in government can influence it and even manipulate it under certain circumstances. Sometimes you just don't file a police case. People may complain, but they won't take it on board. And that's now that's become more difficult with judicial intervention. But still the immunity operates at a powerful level, I think. Where, now you look at any, the other thing is, thanks to the law's delays, there is a huge disincentive for going after anybody, because you know, we did the Bofors investigation, at the end of the day, what came of it in terms of cases, criminal prosecution. And the answer would invariably be nothing. And nobody expected it to be that. The expose took place in the press, that there were certain penalties as a result, certain loss of face, loss of moral reputation. Once in a while you had to resign or you would lose an election. That would be one of the issues in an election. That's it. But you do not expect a corrupt chief minister or prime minister or minister to be put through the whole process and not get away, because there are numerous devices and you can hire very good lawyers. And the conviction rate in India is something like, is less than 5% for serious criminal charges. So this is a major problem. That's the reason I think, I don't believe people are cynical or don't care about corruption. They do. Corruption is a sensitive issue, but the system is such, the details of the system are such that they defeat any attempt to really go after people who are corrupt. If you can prove it to reasonable satisfaction, it's very, very difficult. But it's a subject much discussed in India, and some institutions are trying to do something about it. The Central Vigilance Commissioner and so on, election commissions from time to time during elections, take on the problem, but with poor success. I don't know about what mechanisms are available in China to provide if this immunity exists, but I've not heard of this these scandals reaching the top to anything like the extent we have in India. But there is a folklore of corruption and the reality of corruption. There's also an exaggerated view of corruption in India, which has been written upon. People believe that most politicians are corrupt, even when they are not. And yet those who are corrupt, who are found to be corrupt and defeated politically, could easily come back within 3 or 4 years. It's happened repeatedly in India for various reasons. So it is a fascinating and complex subject which should be taken up as a research program. And John can surely provide many insights into it. Thank you.
Ram, I think we have to draw this evening to on behalf of everybody here, I'd like to thank you very much for an extremely stimulating session.